It seems to me that in conversation around the village in the last few days, I have picked up and joined myself in a lot of talk about the questions of guilt and responsibility. So this forum is a time to talk about that stuff. That might be hard to talk about, although it certainly seems to me historically to be, those of you who are theologians can help me out here, guilt seems to me historically to be something that's very close to the hearts of most Lutherans. In fact, something that Lutherans as a body tend to be quite at home with. I'm not sure, though, that the Lutheran at-homeness with guilt extends to the kinds of questions about guilt and responsibility that we're being faced with these days, and particularly since World War II. Just one or two introductory remarks. It does seem clear to me, as it is, I'm sure, clear to all of you, that the question of guilt gets raised in a new and more compelling collective way from World War II on. That in the discussion of ethics and citizenship that takes place before World War II in Western cultures anyway, the question of guilt and responsibility is really not at the center of discussion. There's some, you know, at the beginning of the United States, in the constitutional discussions and so on, there certainly are constant talks about what citizenship means, what our obligations are as citizens, how we fit into a government, and that kind of stuff. But the urgency that is attached to discussions about collective responsibility, I think, really takes a quantum jump with World War II. And the two things that raise the urgency of that discussion are, one, that we've been thinking about and pondering all day today, the atom bomb, and number two, situation in Nazi Germany with the Jews. Those two events taken together seem to have reinforced for all of us what has now become a commonplace. That is, that human beings are willfully capable of the utmost in evil as a planned strategy, not as an exceptional kind of deed, and that from there on, from 1945 on, from this very date on, August 6, 1945, human beings not only are willfully, are capable of willfully executing evil, but they've got tools the likes of which the Earth has never known. Those two things coming together, the atom bomb and the Holocaust, raises to a new sense of urgency, a new level of urgency, the discussions of guilt, of responsibility, and of commitment. This is not the place to review those discussions, although it seems to me that there could be a lot of profit in doing that. Certainly, we might at some point, you all might at some point, take another look if the events of today have jarred our heads at all again. Take another look at the writings of Hannah Arendt on the question, particularly of collective guilt and collective responsibility. So we've got the Holocaust, we've got the unleashed power to do the evil that we will, and we've got, therefore, the question of guilt and responsibility raised in a new way. Since World War II, it seems to me that the evidence has only mounted for us that the normal sort of Lutheran categories of thinking about guilt and responsibility, and what I mean by the normal sort of Lutheran categories are those categories that talk about guilt and responsibility as an individual thing, that those categories are increasingly in a minor key, and that the major symphony of ethical discussion needs to be about collective guilt, collective responsibility, in a world that gets ever closer intertwined, ever more closely interdependent, and where the hair trigger now points not to individuals who choose to be soldiers, but clearly to whole populations and to the globe 32 times over. So that the question of guilt is now a question about how we understand collective guilt, right? And how we understand collective responsibility, and where in fact the individual then has some kind of way to fit in to those understandings. Let me stop there. This is a forum about guilt and about responsibility. It's one of the most confusing subjects I know about. I suppose a different way of saying that is it's a confusing subject that I don't know about. We need to share our confusion, it seems to me, and see if it's possible to move through guilt to responsibility, and maybe even assuming then some guilt and responsibility, possibly moving through to commitment. That seems to me a progression that's possible, but I'm not sure if it's the only one that's possible. Let's talk about guilt. You know what I'd like to start with? I'd like to start with a question of to those of you who were conscious adults at the time of the explosion of the bomb on August 6, 1945. And ask you if any of you are willing to share with the rest of us. I was a very unconscious infant at that moment. To share with the rest of us what you recall about the times that were covered by the Merton prose poem immediately before and immediately after the explosion of that bomb. What did that seem like, feel like, not seem like, not feel like at the time? And then what have we learned subsequently about it? Anybody who was around and conscious August 6, 1945, want to share anything from those days?
My remembrance of it is that it was the end of the war. I mean, it came on, and I don't remember myself that I had any idea of what it was, you know. We saw pictures of it, and it was described, but, you know, in my remembrance, I can't really fathom what it did.
And so there was no sense that this was sort of any break with weaponry, for instance, of the past.
No,
right?
To me it was not. Mm-hmm. And I was in the service at the time.
Right? Really?
I don't remember, except that it was the end of the war, you know. Uh-huh. And that was a big release. I mean, we've been through
yes.
for some years, you know, of war.
Yes. Yes, sir.
I was over there then, and I was on a carrier. To me, and to everybody on board, and to every other fighting man that I knew of, it was the end of the war. It was over. It wasn't a prolonged killing anymore. We knew we would be coming home soon. And to us, it was one of the greatest things that ever happened. That's it.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember how you heard about it?
Sure. It was announced over the loudspeakers.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember what the words were, or what the sort of tone of the announcement was? Or anything?
That one of the greatest weapons had been unleashed at this time. And they figured right then and there, the skipper of the carrier figured that this would be the end. He figured it was the end of the Japanese Empire. And it was. It brought them to their knees, and it saved millions of American lives. And Japanese, yeah. I feel myself, when I listen to all of this, I hear only what has happened in Japan. I never hear anybody mention what happened at Pearl Harbor. The bombs that they dropped caused as much havoc, as much death, as that bomb at Hiroshima. And not only did it take the military, it took civilian lives there too. So, all that I can say is myself, is war is nothing to be played with. If it could be stopped, I'd be the happiest man on earth. But, I don't know. You've got to get countries to stop it at once.
Okay, others who were around then. Ma'am.
I was a teenager, but I remember H.B. Kaltenborn on the news of reading the eighth song. And it seemed such a strange thing for a radio announcer to be reading, but I can still remember that has made him a little lower than angels. What is man? And it was just a whole aura of mystery and that a great breakthrough in what is this tremendous thing that man is now able to do. I think that was the day the bomb was dropped.
So that was an attempt to communicate that something sort of qualitatively different was taking place with the dropping of this particular bomb, with the use of this particular weapon.
That's the way I remember it.
Kaltenborn was trying to communicate that. Okay. Other memories from them? Yes?
I was at Bible camp at the time, and I remember we got the message that the bomb had dropped, and it was in my memory, a very mixed message. You know, the war will be over, but the horror of the whole thing, I couldn't comprehend it at that time. But I knew it was something really, really big.
Ellen?
This question reminds me of Swanson. Discussion with a woman who had escaped the concentration camp in Latvia. And I was asked what I was doing all the times that she had been interviewed for yes or no. And every one of them was something absolutely, totally trivial and stupid in perspective. And I'm embarrassed at that because I remember exactly where I was in Wilmington, California. I remember hearing it on the radio. I remember seeing it in the paper. I don't remember any reaction. I don't remember whether it was positive or negative about difference or not, because I was preoccupied with getting a train ticket to go back to Chicago after an internship. Mm-hmm. The DJ day took place while I was on the train.
Those of you who recall hearing about this and I gather experiencing it as a welcome matter of course. And that's sort of one summary of what I'm hearing. That is, it's the end of the war, and that's something to be grateful for. But except for the report of the Kaltenborn radio program, there haven't been many indications of the sort of certainty that we've gained, it seems to me, 40 years later, about the qualitative leap that this event meant for humankind, right? It was just not clear on August 6, 1945, that that's what had happened. Right?
No, what everybody was thinking of there was the end of the war.
Sure.
That was all that was on their mind, the fighting was over, and they could get back to a normal life.
And it's clear, you know, as you read the commentary of the scientists who worked on the bomb, both at the University of Chicago and in New Mexico, that they too really did not think much about what it is they had produced until afterwards. I mean, I'm surprised even to think to hear about the Kaltenborn broadcast that day, if in fact it was that day.
I think I remember seeing just fairly recently an old movie, and it was about a fire or something. It was some way out thing. But they were going to use an atom bomb to put out the fire. And I thought, and it was a movie from back in the late 40s, you know. And I thought, you know, we had no idea, most of us, what the real consequences of that was. In this day and age, they would never think of anything like that. It's absolute stupidity.
Something I just need clarification on before anything else is said. Was it ever suggested before the bomb was dropped that Does anyone know if it was suggested that some of the scientists from our government meet with the military or whatever from Japan and take them someplace and show them what this bomb is capable of doing?
Yeah, for those of you who were here from Bob Daggett's reading the Merton piece earlier in the evening, and anybody who's done reading of the sort of revisionist historians who deal with the World War II era, it seems pretty clear now that there were all kinds of indications from the Japanese that in fact they were willing to surrender, and in fact under the very terms that they got after the bombs were dropped. So there is, in fact, the mainstream of American history at this point, not any wacko historians, the mainstream of American history is pretty well agreed that from the point of view of ending the war, the dropping of the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki were not necessary.
There was also, there were also many suggestions that there would be a demonstration.
Well, that's what my question
was.
That was suggested to the people making the decision. That was one of the alternatives they considered.
How would you get two warring countries, though, together to have a demonstration? You know, this is what I cannot fathom in my deepest, is you're out there and you're trying to prove a point. They're trying to kill you just as well as you are them. And they were so fanatic in their beliefs that they were sending airplanes out with no wheels on. And these guys were wrapped, they were human bombs. That is how their belief was. Now, they were wrapped with bandages so that they wouldn't bleed to death before they could fly their airplane into a ship. Mm-hmm. So how are you going to get the leaders, the military leaders, to get together and have a demonstration? You know.
One of the things I remember reading is that it wasn't getting people together, it was just telling them there's going to be a demonstration, and on an uninhabited island, they were going to use it and say, look at it, that's what we're going to use on you. So it wasn't, there were a variety, I think I've read 8 or 10 options that the scientists considered, including one that would simply have blown it up in a place where people would know, but not over the people.
I think there's an indication of that in the film, Day of Trinity. And there are a lot of scientists who reflect back afterwards in the same direction that you're taking now about after it all happened. They reflect that. Yeah. But they mentioned that at that time, that was what a good many, maybe the majority of scientists who were working on it, recommended be done. And the reason that it was not, one of the reasons it was given in response was, suppose it didn't work.
Yeah.
And that, you know, that was the kind of rationale that went through. You can say, now we're going to get a demonstration of everything that's done. Because of,
Well, where does all this leave us? Let's say, in fact, that virtually nobody knew that this weapon was what it turned out to be 40 years ago. And that very few, in fact, knew at that point that they had choices short of dropping the thing on cities and killing 70 to 80,000 people. For those of us who were A, either alive then but unaware, or B, not alive then and becoming aware of this new era of weaponry, what does the fact that we are citizens of a nation which developed it, citizens of a nation of the only nation on earth that's used it, and citizens of a nation that has the most of them, what does that mean to us? What is our relationship to those facts? Does it mean anything? Yes, sir.
Would it have made any difference if it had been Germany and they had their way right in on this? In fact, they were way ahead of us on what they called a heavy water bomb. And would it made of any difference if they would have got it and used it on England before we went ahead and used it? Now, would the guilt have been on England instead of us? Would we have been blaming England for, or I'm not England, but Germany? You know, they were way ahead on this. Their scientists were working on this long before we were.
So, Herman, yeah.
There's a related question that I've wondered about. Would we have dropped the bomb if the Japanese could have dropped one back on us? Or did it make a difference that we were the only one that we could do it with immunity? No, nobody else could do it back on us. Second thing is that we use the word demonstration, and the primary motivation for the dropping of the bomb, as I've understood it from my reading, was not so much to end the war with Japan, because that seemed to be the other way of doing that, but to demonstrate to the Russians what power we had so they wouldn't mess with us. Mm-hmm. So it was supposed to be a way of putting an end to the hostility or the competition between the U.S. and the Soviet, and settling once and for all that sort of thing. And that's the, it seems to me, a key element in the reason for doing it, and gives us some point of reflection for how effective it was.
The third question that raises, if that's the right scenario, and I agree that that's what a lot of people certainly argue was going on, to what degree was racism involved in the fact that we could make the decision to.
But we have been in Europe.
That's right. Yeah.
But, I mean, I'm not sure about this, but it seems to me that at that time, people understanding the bomb as just a bigger bang, you might say, a bigger weapon, comparable damage was done to the Germans with firebombing and other Japanese cities, and also to England by the Germans. So I mean, it seems to me that people just at that time didn't really understand what was being unleashed, and it's that many people still don't really understand that. I think Einstein said that since the splitting of the atom, everything has changed except people's comprehension of it.
It seems to me this whole discussion for me raises a couple of quick questions. I guess one is, what are the conditions under which there is responsibility and guilt? And you suggested one is knowledge, say, of the consequences. And another one is one that I suppose none of us here have had with regard to Hiroshima, that is choice. Even those of you who were aware and alive at the time had no choice in this matter. And it seems to me that both responsibility and guilt, I would think those are a couple of conditions that are necessary. I think I'm a bit more interested in assuming my responsibility as an individual as I move into the future and assess the present. And because I think that I personally and we collectively have knowledge of the consequences of the use of these kinds of weapons. And I think when one is brought to some kind of awareness, we do have some choices. The choices have some consequences, and it's difficult to know completely. There's some risk involved in the choices that are made, but it seems to me that we do have some choices. And I don't have an awful lot of guilt about Hiroshima. Well, I'm not a citizen of the United States, I'm a Canadian, but the circumstance is not that much different. The uranium that was used in the Autumn Blast was mined from Canada and was refined here in Washington State. But I think I'm concerned about responsibility in the future. I guess the second question that it raises, under what conditions would we make the same choice that was made then? And I've heard suggest some of the conditions. One of them is if the nation is at war and has been attacked and there's a tremendous threat. That's one condition. Another is that if people are labeled as being subhuman or being somehow different. And I think those were two conditions that existed at the time. Japan was perceived, Russia was perceived as being a tremendous threat. And indeed, had killed thousands of people. And then these persons, through propaganda or whatever, had become perceived as being somewhat different in nature. And the thing that bothers me about my own complicity now is that I'm often influenced by those same things, by threat and then by the tendency to depersonalize. Maybe that's a third condition, the depersonalization. But to say, well, the Russians are not. They're evil people, therefore it's necessary to make these kinds of choices.
Okay, let's follow into the present then, because that's got to be where this leads us. Question of guilt and responsibility at the present time. Two conditions enumerated here where it's possible that some people will conclude that these weapons should be used. One, nation under threat. Two, enemy dehumanized in some way. Other responses to the issue phrased as a current, present time issue.
I guess I wanted to add just a third question for me, at least, is would it make any difference that those of us who are talking about it are committed to Jesus Christ and not just citizens?
You had, as far as I was concerned, you had Christians fighting this war. Christians that were dying in this last war in World War II. I personally know several of them. It's a time, a place. And the time I felt was then. And I do to this day. I felt if we had to do it all over again to save the lives that we did of our people. I don't know if any of you people know how merciless the Japanese were with people that they captured. Have you ever seen a man with bamboo sticks jammed up under his fingernails and burnt? Have you ever seen a man hung up on a tree and just split wide open? I don't want to see it again. I never do. But at the time, it was the only thing, and it was the best thing that ever happened. It's out of hand now. You've got every country, your third world countries, or even into this now. It's a race. Let's face it. They build bigger, faster cars. They kill more people with them. They're building bigger bombs. They're building bigger airplanes.
What's your response to that as a phenomenon of today?
As a Christian, as I said, I would like to see it stopped. But I still say that you have to protect your families, you have to protect your homes and your country. And that's the whole thing. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
I think there's a big difference between pacifism and nuclear arms. I mean, I don't think there are really that many pacifists in the world when it comes right down to it, who would not, under conditions of threat and duress, perhaps not even exert violence to save their life and the life of their family. I've had some friends who thought they were pacifists until they were into that situation. I don't think using that kind of an argument to say, well, we have to have this, we have to have these bombs. I think that doesn't make any sense. I think even though we can admit that we're not pacifists, I mean, it's still senseless and stupid to continue to build the bomb. I mean, I don't see how you can use the old just war theory. I mean, how can you have a just war in a nuclear age? It seems to be a contradiction of terms.
So you would follow at least part of the way somebody like Merton, who I think at times defined himself as a nuclear pacifist.
Yeah, definitely. But I mean, not a strict pacifist.
Right.
Not a strict pacifist. Yeah. Yes, definitely.
Some people, you know, there are variations on that argument. Some people say that in the nuclear age, given the existence of these stockpiles of weapons and what they can do, straight down the line all the way through pacifism is called for, even if it's more difficult, because any sort of conflict can escalate to the point where these weapons are used, right? Others argue that it's possible to cut off some sort of a line of pacifism, and that a nuclear pacifism can be argued for, which is basically sort of anti-nuclear weapons in its understanding and in its definition of responsibility and activity. But that conventional weapons and other ways of dealing with conflicts are still fine. So there are at least those two sort of tendencies, both of which sometimes call themselves nuclear pacifism.
You don't have to be a pacifist against nuclear war or nuclear armaments.
Mm-hmm. Other reactions on the today question? Where are you? Yes, Tim.
I agree you don't have to be a pacifist, but I think it helps. Because I think if you agree that to respond to violence with violence is okay, then I think that the natural extension of that is a nuclear weapon. Because if someone attacks me and it's okay for me to respond violently, then it only makes sense for me to respond violently if I can respond more violently, more powerfully, in a violent way. And that thing, it's self-escalating, and it ends up with as powerful as we can get, and when we have 20th century technology, the most powerful we get is nuclear weapons. So I think that just beginning by saying it's okay to respond to violence with violence, as soon as you've started that, it's hard to stop that short of nuclear weapons.
I didn't say that. I would love to be a pacifist. But every Sunday I have to read that page 56 or whatever it is in the hymn book that talks about I am in bondage to sin and cannot free myself. And if I take that seriously as a Christian, then I think I have to say, I better understand what's at my base humanity. And if I don't do that, then I'm kidding myself. I think there are as many pacifists in the world as there are atheists. And I think that percentage is very low. And I think I'm simply trying to say, I better understand who I am and what kind of a person I am inside by nature. Or I'm going to live in a dream world so that when push comes to shove in some situations, and if I act violently, I'm going to say, well, the whole house of cards is coming down and nothing stands. I better understand my nature. I guess that's my position. I don't like my nature. I better know it.
Mm-hmm.
And just kind of a follow from something he said triggered is that, you know, in this modern day, where for me, I often wonder, as humans, we take so much responsibility for the issue at hand, you know, our decisions being, you know, so important and all this that goes on, and I just wonder where other people feel that God's overriding power isn't in the whole issue. Something of this magnitude seems to me that it's somewhat out of people's control. Or is it?
You're saying that God's probably not neutral about this?
No.
You're saying that?
No.
He might take control. I'm saying that there's
a larger force. It seems to be an issue that somewhat, certainly complex and probably unsolvable, you know, in human hands. You know, and so where's God's place? You know, that's kind of the question I have for the future. I know that there has to be an element of human responsibility. You can't just say, okay, God's taking care of it all, we can do whatever we want. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not saying that. But maybe some ideas on how that plan is going to work and what that plan might be.
I have the feeling that when we look for God, we don't see a powerful God, an omnipotent God, but we see a suffering God. I don't see that God has entered into human life in a way to stop the violence, whether it was the Holocaust, the Jews, or Vietnam, or the situation in South Africa. I think God raises up people who are willing to suffer on behalf of a creative nonviolence or expression of love, but I don't see God showing power in the sense of stopping the conflict. I think God leaves us the choice, as he left Bonhoeffer, in the decision to use violence in fighting violence. The same choice is being offered to the Central Americans in terms of how they throw off the violence that's being used against them. The same choice is being offered to the Christians and others in South Africa. I think when you look at the kind of power that we have and the Soviet Union has with nuclear weaponry, the choice of violence to restrain violence goes out of all perspective.
For myself, I think we have to work for two things. One is for disarmament, and I'm not sure that we Americans are willing to do that. Coming out of the Second World War, the one ace in the hole that we had was the atomic bomb. The Russians had manpower many more times than we had. And General Haig, who was Secretary of State for somebody or other here, Ronald Reagan, I think, when he started out, and somebody was arguing this issue with him, and he said that if we set aside our atomic bombs, then we're on the same footing with the Russians as we were in 1945. They have the manpower, and we don't. At least we don't have the numbers, and they can walk over Europe just like that. And I remember 1945. That was clearly the reason why we felt so good about the post-war situation and why President Truman could tell the Russians to get out of Iran. He threatened them with the atomic bomb. They didn't have it then, and they had to stop and had to back off and pull out. So even with that reality, that I doubt that Washington will want to do it, because it's a race in the hole against the Russian millions of manpower. In terms of conventional warfare, we can't stand up to them. But I think we still have to work for disarmament. And the second thing, I think, is we have to play for time. All of us remember clearly all the hate things we said about China. When China went communist, we Americans took it as a personal injury, because China was our baby. We forced open-door policy in China, and China was our country. It was not to be dominated by European powers and colonized like the rest. And then they turned their backs on us, and they went communist. And nobody said nastier things about China than did Richard Nixon. And if you remember his campaign against Helen Gegg and Douglas and the nasty things and just...
Amen.
There was nobody better at it than he was.
All through the 50s and
60s. Right. But then when he was in the White House, Kissinger and he did the double take, and now China is just the loveliest country going. So maybe God is working behind this thing. It's sometimes hard to see it, even if we are Isaiah or whoever. But maybe Ronald Reagan's in the White House. This is my hope and prayer. And nobody has clout with the right wing in this country today like Richard Nixon had with the right wing about 10 years ago. So if anybody can pull it off, it's Ronald Reagan. In terms of a kind of thing that Richard Nixon did with China some years ago. And if we can do it with China, this is what I tell myself and the congregation I serve. I said it rather timidly once or twice. They say it can't be done. I say, look, Richard Nixon did it with China, and read the literature before. So I say the second thing is we have to come up with time. And if Ronald Reagan is not up to doing it, I think God would like it done, but whether he's listening to his voice or not. Then maybe another one. Some far right winger, whom most of us just have holy horror thinking of in the White House. But those are the guys that'll do it in terms of a peace movement in Russia. It might be the money boys who insist on it, because Coca-Cola opened up China to us. We know that. That's my view.
At least a semi-hopeful note.
Does that mean we're supposed to work to elect those guys?
That I have no opinions about. It's awful, but Richard Nixon did it. The climate is entirely different. But one last thing, and that is we Americans are capable of it. We're capable of doing the vilest things in the world. You can talk about the Japanese. I fought in the Second World War, and I said all the nasty things about them, and I was ready to shoot them all down. But when we Americans dropped that atomic bomb, the scientists developed it, but the military did it. The military will do anything. They'll do Kent State tomorrow. They did it once. I think they'll do it again.
But who is military?
And then.
Who was military then? Military was the man drafted off of the street. He was no professional. I went in at 17 on my own free will. I was no professional. I'd done what I was told. Everybody else had. You can't blame military. Military does what they are told to do.
Correct. That's my point. Right. The generals, somebody makes the decision and the generals will do it. And in Vietnam, they did it over and over again. And if you make a study of what Americans did in Vietnam in terms of brutality and downright bestiality, I'm not sure the Russians are doing any worse in Afghanistan. I read the New York Times every day and I haven't seen any evidence that the Russians are doing that kind of thing. Agent Orange and what Curtis LeMay said, we'll bomb them into the Stone Age. We tried to do it in Vietnam. So we'll do it as quick as the next person.
You took your own hopeful ending and sort of turned it up. It's not enough to give us hope here at the end. Yes.
I think that concept of collective guilt is a problematic one. I think that we can recognize that each of us individually is influenced by our society and by our culture, but I think as Christians, we have to make our choices as individuals. The concept of collective guilt at the Nuremberg trials, for instance, was ruled out. Otherwise, Eichmann would not have been convicted because he said, I did what I was told to do. I stood with my society. Sometimes Christians have to stand with their conscience and stand with their God and stand against the society if we perceive our society as doing something which is problematic. I think there's a strong sense of individual responsibility which is important. And I think for myself I've accepted the just war theory, but I'm a nuclear pacifist, which is a kind of a very mixed bag. And the Lutheran Church in America a couple of years ago came up with a statement, and so I tried to work this issue through. My church helped me gave me an occasion to help think about this. I'm not very happy with the statement that our church has come up with. I think that there's a tremendous illusion that the building up of arms is going to bring peace in the world. And perhaps as a non-American, you know, I'm part of that 80% majority in the world who are neither Russians nor Americans, and we're being influenced. The rest of us are being influenced by the decisions of you folks. Who the hell do you think you are, you know? I suppose is one of the questions that many people, the World Council of Churches, this is what many of the smaller countries of the world were saying. I think that there are alternatives, and I think the alternative is arms reduction. Maybe not disarmament, but arms reduction, balanced arms reduction. Building trust, breaking down perceptions, which are often misperceptions. Walking the moccasins of the Russians, who twice had to beat off invading armies, who lost a whole generation of their people, who are deathly afraid that they will be invaded again. Sometimes, so I think we have to build an awful lot of trust. I think that's a Christian way that we are challenged to take. And I think that's a hopeful thing. There have been agreements, disarmament agreements, in certain parts of the world that certain types of weapons will not be tested, and many of those agreements have been successful. So we ought not to despair, but we have to get in there and fight for peace.
Adequate benediction.
Adequate benediction. Sounds good.
Fight for peace.
I think one of the things that I have trouble with is just the word guilt. People who know me know I've spent a lot of time being guilty over things in my life. Like, for instance, having something to eat when 2/3 to 3/4 of the world are starving, or getting in my nice car and driving somewhere when, you know, somebody in Haiti is walking or using oxygen or whatever. And then it dawned on me that I didn't like the word guilt, because it sort of hampered me to do anything about the situation. And I don't feel guilty about Hiroshima, because I wasn't alive. I feel horror, and I cry when I hear about it or read about it or see movies, because it was an ugly thing. I think anything like that is ugly. I think war is ugly, no matter what kind of war it is. I think my concern is is getting over the guilt feeling, because I don't feel we can go very far if we're constantly feeling guilty. And we're made to feel guilty about so many things, about what we did to the Indian. Those things are in the past. And guilt usually is something to do with the past. And I think we have to get out of the past and look at the present and work towards how we can make the change. And I guess that's what I'm struggling now. You know, what can I do as a Christian? I can educate people. And I think, basically, you know, we're so hung up on the word communism. We really don't know, a lot of people don't even know what the word is. You know, they just hear the word and it's something scary and it's something negative, and I will admit it scares me to a point. But the Soviet people are just like us. I mean, they have kids, they have jobs, they have feelings. If there would be some way that the countries, the people, not the governments, not the militaries, but the people could work together, get together, and of course a lot of cities are doing that with sister cities and that sort of thing. But in order for it to be successful, I really think there has to be an effort by each one of us. you know, whether it's having Pen Pal Family Sojourners magazine, I know, have offered one time in the back, if you wanted to be a pen pal with a Russian family, and we did write, but we never did hear anything on it. Send a picture of your family, and I think that's where it's going to start. We can't keep beating ourselves because we dropped the bomb on Hiroshima. I mean, we did it. It's over. We have done uglier things. Everybody in the world has done ugly things. And I guess, to me, killing is killing. Whether we kill with our tongues or drop a bomb or shoot someone, I don't think God looks at it as one being worse than the other. I think they're all the same.
Yeah, I think I react against the word guilt too. I guess we do as a team. The gentleman that spoke over there earlier is our pastor. And I think one of the things that he's done for us throughout the years is reinforce the fact that we're human. God did not make us perfect. We struggle with that, one heck of a lot. My wife and I have a hard time keeping our marriage pacifistic at times, let alone trying to think about the world's problems. And so I'm not so sure that I'm optimistic that we're going to live in a perfect world. But our responsibility as Christians is to proclaim the good news of Jesus Christ. And that's a continual trying thing. And it's writing to Sojourners three times to try to get the name of a Russian family. It's, you know, it's going out and doing something in his name and getting shoved away. And going back. And it's responsibility, I guess, to spread the good news, to get others to try to do the same thing, to try to be the example. And when you have that kind of hope, then you can walk around, not with a gooey smile on your face, but with a good feeling of hope in the world. A
couple more comments. Yes, ma'am.
I'm from Grand Forks, North Dakota, and a lot of you from the Midwest might be familiar with it. We have an Air Force base right out of town, and we also have a lot of missiles. And I found out today that the Trident submarine is the third largest nuclear power. We used to think North Dakota was. You know, the community is really divided in Grand Forks because they really feel that the missiles should be there for protection. And then there's a lot of people who become real peace activists and are protesting out at the Air Force Base. And I thought the comment on trust was good because about a year and a half ago, North Dakota did a study for the people in Grand Forks because we felt that we'd be number one on Russia's list to be bombed because of our missiles in the area. And they told us that what we could do is hop in our car and drive to Jamestown, North Dakota, which is almost half, and a third across the state away from us. Real unrealistic. What the people in Grand Forks did, though, is we did adopt a sister city in Russia, by the name of Isham. And what's really neat is to watch the mailings from the grade schools in Grand Forks, North Dakota, go out and receive mailings back from the kids in Isham. And all of a sudden, they aren't depersonalized anymore. All of a sudden, you know, it kind of brings a feeling of unity. And I thought that was really a neat thing. We've had about 7 or 8 mailings over the last year, you know, back and forth. And it really builds a sense of community. You know, I think that's a good goal to strive for.
Hopeful story. Thanks. Yeah.
Thank you.
Tim, you got something else?
Yeah. Responding a little bit to both of those, whereas I don't think it's good to just sit around and feel guilty. I think it's important to identify my complicity in something that's very bad. I can see that we're in a bad situation, and then it's important for me to see where I'm connected with it, where I'm complicit in this bad situation. Like I can see that I'm contributing to the problem in that I'm dehumanizing Soviet people. So once I see that complicity, I can respond to it. Rather than just feeling guilty for dehumanizing them, I can respond to it by writing to them, having a sister city, that kind of thing. And I can also see that I'm complicit in it, in things like in that I'm paying for it with my tax dollars. And then rather than sitting around feeling guilty, for paying for it, I can stop paying for it. So in that way, identifying my guilt or my complicity can be a motivator to work for change.